From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, how science has progressed in the way we approach traumatic head injuries, and whether we're now being too cautious.
Later, former Bodine's frontman Sam Yannis responds to the serious allegations he molested the stepdaughter of a former bandmate.
If something like this did happen to Tessa Newman, my heart, even after all this, still goes out to her. You know, but I am not the guy who did it.
Plus, Bubbler Talk returns to an iconic Milwaukee tavern that is now up for sale.
And Milwaukee Magazine's Carol Nixon speaks in praise of water recreation here.
Yesterday I was out with a friend and we got so hot, we were playing tennis, and she said, let's go swimming. And we went to Atwater and we dove in. Later I found out the water was 58 degrees, but it felt great.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Soccer, or football, fans around the world are enjoying the building excitement over the World Cup, which is on to the quarterfinal round beginning today in Russia. The quadrennial event has been filled with nail-biting games, but also a fair number of injuries.
The way those injuries have been treated has led many to question whether FIFA, the governing body of world soccer, is treating the dangers of concussions adequately. Soccer is just the latest sport where head injuries have been the source of controversy. And, of course, it's not just elite-level athletes who are sustaining concussions.
Dr. Michael McCray sees many concussions in his work as a researcher and professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he believes there should be caution rather than fear about the potential for head injury in sports. He is with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
And thank you for having me.
There is obviously a lot of talk about head injuries, traumatic brain injuries, concussion when it comes to sports like football, in which there is a lot of direct contact with the head. Are there sports, though, that we might not think about as necessarily being contact in the same way as a sport like football or hockey that we ought to be when it comes to traumatic brain injuries?
Sure. I think the simple answer to that question is yes, but perhaps with some nuance. So you're absolutely right that this topic or this the focus on sport-related concussion is something that has gone really from near absolute obscurity 15 or 20 years ago when you and I were participating in sports to now really mainstream household conversations across America and around the world as parents like myself evaluate the potential risks to young athletes and are making decisions about whether they should participate in certain sports. And I'll touch on that a bit here today too. But for the most part, even in a research paradigm, we try to bucket sports into full contact or collision sports like football, like ice hockey, where heavy contact is just a central tenet of the game. Then there are a number of sports known as limited contact, and that's basketball and sports like it, where we have the occasional occurrence of concussion, oftentimes by freak accidents, volleyball players who strike the post on the net or hit their head on the floor. But contact really isn't a central part of the strategy of the game. And then the third bucket are really non-contact sports. And right here in Wisconsin, a famous quote from decades ago was from Vince Lombardi, who once said, football's not a contact sport, it's a collision sport. We have surveillance and research activities across all three, full contact or collision sports, limited contact sports, and non-contact sports, to better understand this injury across the landscape.
When it comes to the limited contact or the non-contact sports, are there things that we ought to be looking at in terms of mitigating the possibility of concussion? Or do we accept that when concussions happen, these are generally freak injuries or collateral damage, if you will, and our focus ought to be just on helping the athlete recover?
I think the latter. So I also spend most of my clinical time seeing people from the general population who have various forms of concussion or traumatic brain injury that obviously sometimes happen in high-speed motor vehicle crashes, But a good many of them happen in freak accidents, falls at home, slips on the ice, something fall while you're doing a home improvement project or something. And the same could really be said for those non-contact and limited contact sports. The incidence of head injury in those sports is very low. The risk to athletes is essentially zero. And really, it's about promoting the overall health and safety of athletes participating in those sports, whether it's golf or basketball, without really a need for a major overhaul to prevent concussion.
There's no need for a soccer helmet.
That's correct. Absolutely.
As you say, there was a point at which this stuff was in the annals of obscurity, if you will. It is really not the case anymore. Just in the last 5-10 years, there has been so much more attention paid to it. How far has the research come in that period of time in terms of understanding what's happening to our brain when it's recovering from a concussion?
Well, we've made enormous strides, both in terms of the science of concussion, and what I like to say is how we'll all be judged in the end in the scientific community is, what difference did it make? And the good news there is that the research has really rapidly translated from science to clinical practice. So an example here is that many years ago when I was participating in sports, if you go back even 20 years, literally the state of the art for concussion assessment, I realize we're on radio here, was was someone raising two fingers and asking the athlete, if we asked them anything at all, how many fingers am I holding up or where are we, which were very crude and blunt methods for assessing concussion. And it was commonplace for an athlete to return to the field of play within minutes of their injury.
Right. Now there's something called the concussion protocol.
Absolutely. So over the years, applied studies by our group and others around the world have given us a better understanding of the natural course of recovery after concussion, both in terms of the resolution of clinical signs and symptoms. But we also now, if you can imagine, we've gone from how many fingers to using things like protein blood biomarkers to better understand how long does it take for the brain to recover. We've utilized those research findings to inform international consensus guidelines, as you say, to form concussion protocols. Nobody returns to play on the same day anymore. That is essentially unheard of at any competitive level. Once the player's been properly evaluated and there's suspicion of concussion, they are then removed and not eligible for return to play the same day. We also don't then flip a switch and return an athlete to the soccer field the next day. They go through a graded exertion program over a period of days where we can conduct some rehabilitative techniques and give them adequate time for brain rest and recovery before returning to unrestricted play.
Well, and how much of this is an understanding that there is really no one-size-fits-all approach, that each player's reaction or recovery from a concussion may well be different than the next?
That's a terrific point. Not only is the presentation and the course of recovery different across athletes, but the complexion of the injury also varies. This is a very heterogeneous injury, meaning some of my colleagues like to say that concussions are like snowflakes. No two are alike. One athlete may have a predominance of cognitive difficulties with very little headache or dizziness. The next athlete, perhaps even within the same game, may have real predominance of headache and dizziness, but they're cognitively intact. How that has really informed international consensus guidelines is we now use a multidimensional approach to assess concussion. It's not simply about asking an athlete about their symptoms. It's about conducting a detailed evaluation of their cognitive function, their motor function, and other neurologic function.
Talk more about these protein biomarkers that come into play.
Yeah, this is really an exciting breakthrough. And our group at the Medical College of Wisconsin, so we are studying the utility of both neuroimaging markers using advanced MRI technologies and blood markers of certain proteins that are known to be indicators of, for instance, neuronal cell injury or axonal injury in the brain caused by trauma. We're exploring the utility of these markers in both civilian neurotrauma patients with traumatic brain injury from car accidents, traumas, and falls, for instance, and in athletes with sport-related concussion. We find that in some of these markers, there is really a spike elevation within hours post-injury that are markers of injury, but where these markers may also have great utility as an indicator of recovery, for instance, 7 to 10 days later. And again, aimed at telling us not only, as odd as this sounds, not only when the athlete is fit to return to play, but when his or her brain is fully recovered and fit to return to play.
How difficult is it to study this, given that you don't want to give the general population or athletes or anyone a concussion to use as, say, a control group?
Yeah, so we've been at this a long time. Our group has been studying the effects of traumatic brain injury and sport-related concussion for about 25 years. And early on, it was very difficult. This was not household discussion 25 years ago, and we had a great difficulty sometimes convincing athletes and schools to participate in our research projects. Since then, we've probably enrolled 75,000 athletes. We have one project now, the NCAA DoD Care Consortium, where we've enrolled 45,000 collegiate student athletes and military service academy members. We have data on over 3,500 concussions. It takes a lot of work on the ground to have these surveillance systems in place so that when the injury occurs, we have a protocol that we can activate within minutes, engage them, and then a follow-up protocol over a period of hours, days, weeks, and months to follow their recovery.
How important is follow-up months down the road in terms of, A, as a researcher, understanding the kind of recovery that the brain is able to accomplish, and B, taking care of a patient who may have presumably mostly recovered after a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, but there may still be some damage there that that needs to be followed?
Sure. Really good question. To fully understand the natural history of injury, we used to think of this in terms of, you know, what are the effects of traumatic brain injury within hours or days? We've learned over time that the effects of traumatic brain injury might be detected differently at different time courses. So all of our studies now involve longer-term follow-up of patients and athletes. In the setting of sports, there's a lot of discussion about the potential long-range neurologic health risks to athletes. That's been talked a lot about in the media because of a select study of a small number of former professional athletes. Our data really indicate for your listeners who are parents like me of youth and high school athletes that the risk to your son or daughter or mine is extremely small and certainly much smaller than the benefit they realize from participation in sports. In the more severe form of traumatic brain injury in civilian patients who are exposed to motor vehicle crashes and more severe forms of injury, the recovery course is really on a scale of weeks to months, much longer than what we see in sport-related concussion, where the overwhelming majority of athletes achieve a complete recovery somewhere in the order of 1 to 2 weeks.
As someone in practice who presumably comes into the metaphorical contact with a fair number of both athletes and parents and also coaches, do you have more of an issue today with people taking this seriously or people taking it too seriously?
I would say for certain the latter. So like anything else in medicine and science, sometimes the pendulum swings a bit too far and then has to come back to center for the universe to make sense. I like to say that 20 years ago, I spent most of my time in the clinic arm wrestling with dads, typically, trying to convince them that their son or daughter needed a couple more days of rest before returning to the soccer field, for instance. We spend a great deal of time now convincing parents that their son or daughter is going to be perfectly fine, that they should start exercising, it's perfectly safe to do so, and that they're really at no great increased risk long-term should they continue participation in sports. Our research program at MCW has forever been based really on advancing the science, improving clinical practice in that translational model, but also promoting the benefits to young people of participating in competitive athletics.
What were the sports that you played growing up?
In high school, I played four sports. I played football, basketball, baseball, and track and field.
At this point, you know, some years down the road, do you reevaluate the various collisions and potential head injuries that you sustained when you were younger?
Oh, Oh, I'd be lying if I said the guys I played with in high school and after that, if we didn't have a joke or two about it. But I do have sort of a renewed perspective. But I'll be honest with you, that renewed perspective at my age is not focused solely on concussion. It's about my orthopedic health and my knees and elbows and shoulders. Certainly, I have my aches and pains, but I would not trade the experience of participation and the benefits it provided to me in my life really for anything at this point.
We have come a long way, though, since somebody gets a big hit and they just say, well, he really got his bell rung.
Absolutely. And nobody, myself included, nobody is proposing that we go back to the way things were when I played ball years ago, again, where I mentioned it was really commonplace for athletes to return to the field of play the same day as they were injured. We believe that the science really has informed the international consensus guidelines. We've seen a significant reduction in the occurrence of repeat concussions. We're seeing athletes now. Buzz phrase here is that in about 15 years, we've gone from athletes being withheld from play for 15 minutes to now 15 days. And that's gone a long way in protecting the health and safety of our young athletes.
Dr. Michael McRae, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Michael McRae is professor of neurosurgery and neurology and the director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also a neuropsychology consultant for the Green Bay Packers. You'll find a link to more about his research at WUWM.com.
We speak with former Bodines musician Sam Yannis about the serious allegations against him when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There are a few more days of Summerfest along Milwaukee's lakefront, featuring enthusiastic audiences watching sets by scores of musicians. Sam Yannis will not be among them. Yannis is not on the Summerfest roster amid allegations that have shaken fans of the band he co-founded, the Bodines.
A series of articles in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel detail allegations by the stepdaughter of the other Bodines frontman, Kurt Newman. Tessa Newman says Yannis sexually molested her beginning when she was 9 years old and continued into her teenage years. She said Yannis also engaged in sexual conversations with her when she was a child. We have a link to the Journal Sentinel's coverage of the story at our website.
As those stories indicate, no lawsuit or criminal investigation is reportedly underway. Yannis declined to do an interview with the newspaper about the charges. He did, however, agree to a radio interview to answer the allegations. Obviously, this is subject matter of a sensitive nature that is probably not suitable for younger listeners. Sam Yannis, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
So these are obviously difficult things to discuss. Let me ask you an obvious question. Why are you talking about them with me and on this program?
Well, we wanted to get on record with a source that we feel is credible.
Right. So I guess I was going to ask this later in the interview, but I'll ask you this now. Why, when these allegations were first coming together, did you not speak with the reporter at the Journal Sentinel?
Nobody asked me anything, you know, and also they're absolutely false allegations. There's no reason to talk about it. Well, there was no reason to talk about it. Now I feel there is a reason to talk about it.
Well, so let's start then with the question that we need to ask. You have been publicly accused of molesting the stepdaughter of your former bandmate over the course of several years. Did you ever have any sexual contact with her?
Absolutely not. No contact whatsoever. Like I stated before, I barely knew her from the time they're saying it started when she was 9 years old. I barely knew her then. You know, it wasn't until years later when I got to know her, obviously a little over the years, because, you know, she was around, you know, but she wasn't, we were never together alone ever. You know, she wasn't around that much. And when she was around, everybody else was around. It wasn't like she was there by herself. Her mother was there. Her father was there. The band was there. The crew was there, you know, and all other kinds of people were always around.
What about just physical contact? Contact that one person years later could see one way and another might take another way.
There were never any, even after years later when we became, you know, friends, there was never any kind of like long lingering hugs or anything like that that could be in any way misconstrued as that sort of behavior.
So the allegations that you forced her to perform sexual acts on you
are completely false and fabricated.
The published reports also say there were conversations of a sexual and sometimes crude nature with her. Did any of those conversations exist?
Absolutely not. You know, I mean, to me, it's just ludicrous. I do not have any kind of reputation for that sort of behavior. I mean, they say I've made crude remarks. You know, I defy any man anywhere to deny that they have made crude remarks at some point in their life. Yes, I've said some crude things, but never to her and never, with those intentions or anything like that.
As we're having this conversation, the most recent report in the Journal Sentinel makes reference to a video where you're apparently making a vulgar joke. And the report says the video was shot by Tessa Newman, who was accusing you of these things.
I don't know what that proves. You know, it proves that she was there. But if you watch the video, you know, we're all there. We're sitting down having a meal. And if you I'm paying more attention to that pizza than I am to her.
Can you tell? You said you got to know her over the years. What kind of relationship how would you describe your relationship with her?
I would describe the relationship that we finally had was like pals. You know, at a certain point, she was on the road more than just. Intermittently, you know, in the beginning, yes, you know, the kids would be there sometimes, but it wasn't until a certain point, I don't remember the exact year, but she was definitely on the road with us for a while, you know, in the duties of a nanny, let's say, you know, and that's when we sort of started palling around a little bit because that's what happens on the road. You know, you're with the same people and, you know, bonds are formed. But it was as innocent as anything could be. We were just pals. You know, we shared the same sense of humor. So if I was making some sort of comment like that, she was laughing. It wasn't like, you know, she was in any kind of position where she had to be on guard or fearful of anything like that.
I'm obviously not a lawyer here, and we should make it clear that nothing that we talk about in the studio amounts to a hearing or a deposition or anything of a legal nature. And there does appear to be a burden of proof that the people accusing you would have to live up to. And at the same time, the reports have pointed to some inconsistencies between what you've said, I think what you said on another radio show, Mark Belling's show, and what they say they can establish, things like dates and ages. Do you account at all for those inconsistencies?
Well, it was a long time ago, you know, like I guess, you know, around 15 years ago. It's hard to remember exact dates or ages or anything like that, you know. So if you know, my answers are, a bit inconsistent like that, well, I think that's just natural, you know. I think the major point is none of that ever happened, you know. And why aren't they pressing charges? If they're so sure that something happened, where are these charges, you know? And I want to repeat that. If something like this did happen to Tessa Newman, my heart, even after all this, still goes out to her, you know. But I am not the guy who did it, you know. I don't know if it happened, but if it did, that's my statement about it.
You talk about your relationship as being kind of like pals. Did she ever talk about the troubles that she was going through with you? I know she mentioned in the initial Journal Sentinel article that she went through some addiction issues and some other difficulty. Were those the kinds of things that ever came up?
I had no idea that she was involved with drugs, and I had very little idea about. I knew that she was taken out of school at some point. I don't really know much about that. At a certain point, I found out about, you know, those kinds of things because they weren't, you know, the family was not really forthright about, you know, they were, oh, guess what? You know, it wasn't like that, you know, but, you know, she was home. She wasn't in school.
Obviously, you know, I've never been in a rock band, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that there are things like alcohol and drugs that go around with a touring rock band. Did that kind of thing ever come up to you, what you can remember with her around?
Well, can you be more specific about what
you're
asking?
Well, I guess, you know, did you ever see her drinking? Did you ever drink with her? Were there drugs that you used that she used?
I never saw her drinking. And after the shows, I was more interested in hanging out with the guys and having some beers. You know, So that's where I was. I was, you ask the crew, you know, I mean, if you interviewed any crew members, you know, oftentimes we were in my room, you know, that's what we were doing. I was not ever alone with her after any show.
Let me ask you the question that I think, you know, many people would want to hear an answer to. And, you know, maybe it's an unfair question to you, but I'll ask it anyway. You know, these are pretty unpleasant things that Tessa has accused you of.
Yeah.
What would be her motivation for making them up?
You know, I have no real idea, except for the fact that the Newmans have been trying to derail me since I left the band. And I can say that they've been lying to everybody since the day I left that band, because they say that I quit the band by text message. My leaving the band was not an action. It was a reaction. Kurt Newman sent me an email saying a number of things, and then he ended it by saying, "Bodine's is over. The only thing left now is the details of the split." And that's when I reacted to that and said, okay, if that's how you feel, okay, I'm out. Kurt Newman broke up the Bodines, not me. I did not quit. And since that happened, they've been going around saying that I left the band to pursue a solo career. He has never admitted that he's the one that broke up the band. So that from day one, they're lying to position himself as a, you know, as a wounded warrior carrying on in the face of adversity. Oh, poor Kurt. Oh, what a hero he is, you know. So they've been lying since then, and they've continued to lie about many things.
Are there other things you wanted to mention?
Well, that they've been saying that, you know, I've been trying to derail their career, you know. That's not true. That's another one. I can't think of anything else right now.
Before these allegations, I know the allegations first came up on Facebook, and then, you know, some months later, it was the Journal Sentinel article. Did they ever talk to you about them before any of this went public?
I'm sorry, did who ever talk to me about it?
The Newmans.
No, they never brought it up to me directly. I think the first time I heard about anything like this was when the mother of my son said something to me about it. She told me that Barbara said to her at one point that—
Barbara is Kurt's
Barbara
wife.
Newman, right. Yes. She said to the mother of my son, if I really want to bring Sam down, I know how to do it, and I can do it, and I will do it. I wasn't there, but something to that effect. That's the first time I heard about something, you know. And then later on, a man up north was doing an interview with me, and he had also done an interview with Kurt Newman, and he told me that there were some allegations of misconduct that were brought up in the interview he did with Kurt.
But the allegations were, they didn't go into what they were, or?
No, he wasn't real specific, you know. But, you know, I never paid it a whole lot of attention because I thought it was just a joke. Because it is a joke. This never happened, you know. They're not going to do anything with this because they'd be foolish to.
Well, so if these allegations are entirely unfounded, let me go back to my initial question. Why go on the radio with me and earlier with Mark Belling? Why not file a suit for slander and put this into the actual court system as opposed to the court of public opinion?
Well, my lawyer told me that a case like that is almost impossible to win, and it would probably bankrupt me. You know, I can't prove, you know, that she's lying, just like she can't prove that, you know, what I'm saying is not the truth. I think it would be a foolish move. I mean, if I was rich, we would be in court right now, you know, because I would love to see that happen. But I can't afford to do that.
Your lawyer's not willing to take it on pro bono.
Well, I doubt that. We have not discussed that, but but like I said before, you know, I feel like I have to say something. I think people want to hear me say something about it.
How often is this in your mind these days?
It's hard to get it out of my mind these days. You know, it's been a rough time. You know, obviously, I mean, I can't think of, you know, anything worse happening to somebody. You know, if I was guilty, okay, that's one thing, but To thrust this kind of accusation on an innocent man is unforgivable, you know.
Do you go back and replay, you know, interactions that you may have had with the Newmans or with Tessa herself, and think, you know, could I have done something at this point? You know, are you thinking about what your relationship with her was like?
Sure, I thought about a lot of things, but you know, I'll say it again: none of anything like that ever happened. Not once, never.
You have been making a new album and getting it ready for release. Is that still moving forward?
Absolutely. The record was actually released on the 15th officially. It's been out. It's been done and out and available for a while, but officially it was released on June 15th. Return of the Goya Part 1, it's, I think, my finest work to date. It's been getting tremendous reviews. And that's another suspicion. You know, their timing with this story coming out. They knew my record was coming out. They follow me like a hawk on Facebook, you know. And anybody who's ever had any kind of dealings with Barbara Newman will attest to the fact that that's how she is. She knows that this kind of thing is impossible for me to disprove. That's why they're coming with this particular kind of accusation at this particular time, I believe. They wanted to hurt me, and they have. And there's no taking it back. From this day forward, if anybody ever Googles my name, that article will come up. This is exactly what they wanted to do, and it's been done, and it cannot be undone.
So what do you
especially considering that there's no charges, there have been no charges, and I believe there will be no charges because there was no crime. There's no evidence of any wrongdoing whatsoever.
So what do you do now, aside from speak with me?
Well, I don't know. To tell you the truth, I really don't know. I think I have to wait and against the advice of my attorney. I mean, he said, don't say anything. You know, he says, the more you say, the more you're going to keep the story alive. And I suppose that's true. But like I said before, I feel like I should say something. And after we're done doing all we can do to speak our side of the story, you know, time will tell. I really don't know, you know. Can I say also that I hope and pray that people can see through this for what it truly is, and over time we'll realize that, you know, I am innocent and take me back and, you know, into the fold, so to speak.
Your Summerfest gig was canceled. Do you have other concerts to this point that are planned?
Yes, not everybody has canceled out on me, but I would say half of them have. You know, anything involving like family oriented, you know, events. Of course, they don't want to be anywhere near this, you know. But I have several private shows that will go on, and a few others that haven't canceled yet. You know, it could still happen, but it's really hurt me financially, you know.
This is a strange question to ask. Given everything, how do you sleep at night?
I sleep fine because I know in my heart what happened and what did not happen. And I would say that they're the ones having trouble sleeping at night. I hope so, because if not, that means they're so far gone that, you know, it's sad.
Have you at any point since this has surfaced sought to talk to either Kurt or anyone with the Newmans directly?
I reached out to Tessa Newman when I first heard the story was going to come out. And all I did, I asked her why. Why? I got no response.
Samianis, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck to you.
Thank you. I appreciate the airtime.
Milwaukee musician Sam Yannis was co-founder of the group The Bodines. Our interview was edited for Time. You can find a link to the articles in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel detailing the allegations against Yannis by his former bandmate Kurt Newman and Newman's stepdaughter Tessa at WUWN.com.
There is more of Lake Effect after a break on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If we can believe the prevailing weather forecast, we're in store for a very nice weekend around southeastern Wisconsin. We're expecting plenty of sunshine with temperatures in the 70s and 80s. It's a nice change from the hot and humid 4th of July we just had.
It should be a delightful weekend for getting in the water or out on the water. Milwaukee Magazine's cover story this month offers a definitive guide for enjoying the dozens of recreational opportunities the region provides to enjoy the wonders of H2O. Carol Nixon is editor-in-chief and publisher of Milwaukee Magazine, and she is with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Well, Mitch, I'm so happy to be here, as always.
We're going to talk specifically about fun on the water in this interview. We should mention, though, that it's really a water-themed issue for July, right?
It is. This one was a ton of fun to put together. In addition to having this feature, which has all these different things that you can do in and on the water around Milwaukee, we also have a great excerpt from John Gerda's book about this fishing village that used to exist sort of near the where the home bridge is now.
This is Jones Island.
Yes, exactly. And then really another fun story about one person in particular, but he's part of a trend of people who seek out spring water right from the spring, and they call it raw water, and they believe it has a lot of different health benefits. And anyway, it's great. It's a great read.
So let's talk about, and there are a variety of subject areas within this article called Make Waves. And mm-hmm. I thought it made sense just to talk about, you know, one or two of them in each section. The one called Cruise is an obvious kind of slam dunk because there is one particular cruise that you highlight.
Yes, it is. We do. It's the cruise on the sailboat, the Dennis Sullivan, which calls the Discovery World its home. And you can go out on these afternoon cruises or evening sunset cruises. And it's this great replica of a 19th century schooner. And, you know, you get to experience the quietude of the lake and, you know, close your eyes and imagine what it felt like before there were motorboats and all those other things. And it's just, I have not done it. It's on my list for the summer.
And in a time of the year when you're on land, the most frequent sound is the sound of Harley Davidsons going up and down the street. This is a direct contrast to that.
Yes, exactly.
So the Dennis Sullivan, I have not done that. I've been on the boat before, but mm-hmm. I have never taken the full-on cruise before. And I gather they're doing a trip up to Door County and back, which sounds like it would be an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, that's a several-day-long trip. And last summer, I think they went to Erie, Pennsylvania, so they were really taking long trips on this. And I think that would be a great experience. Get a stack of books and you know,
make sure you got
out.
A lot of vacation time saved up for that one, though. All right, so we also move on to we keep thinking in terms of Lake Michigan, but there are really lots of lakes around Milwaukee as well. And you have a section called Explore Lake Country, and there are lots of things that you can do there. But what are a couple of things that people might not have considered?
Well, you know, I think if you don't live on a lake or near a lake in Waukesha County, you might think that these lakes are not accessible to you. But indeed, they are. In fact, depending on how you want to get involved, you can join a yacht club, and you don't have to own like a full-on yacht. These are really sailboat clubs, and they offer all kinds of lessons and also just social activities. And so that's one way to experience the lakes. Another, you know, lower commitment is to just go have a meal on the lake. We list quite a few different places that have beautiful outdoor decks and where you can enjoy the water.
There's a picture in this of people dining on a sort of an enclosed deck at the Golden Mast, but it looks like a beautiful view. The Golden Mast is in...
That one is...
Okauchee.
Yes, Lake Okauchee.
So Lake Country seems like a great opportunity. And you were mentioning lessons, and there might be people for whom Lake Michigan seems intimidating who might be more likely to try to take up sailing in a more sheltered lake.
Absolutely. And I think that the sense of community is one of the things that sounds the most appealing to me. And also on Lake LaBelle, or I don't know if they say
Lac-LaBelle.
Lac-LaBelle,
I think, yes.
I never know. Is it LaCroix or LaCroix?
LaCroix, exactly.
But at any rate, they have these pontoon boat tours where they take you around the lake and they point out all the historic homes and different things. And that just sounds great, too. That's during a very limited time in August. So you have to look up the info on that if you want to do it.
Plenty of people use the lakes, whether it's Lake Michigan or one of the smaller lakes, to go swimming. And you make some recommendations on what some of the beaches, aside from the ones we all know along, you know, Bradford Beach and what have you, there are also nice beaches in lake country as well.
Yes. And that's another, I think, surprise to some people, is that there are public beaches. There's also public boat access on most of the lakes. I think there's just one that doesn't have a public boat access. But yeah, you can go to Oconomowoc City Beach. You can go to Bender Beach. You can go to Pewaukee Public Beach. That's probably the most well-known. But, Mitch, I have to tell you something, because you know how excited I get about swimming. And, you know, every year since I've been here, I've had this, like, debate or I don't know, just this struggle with Lake Michigan, because it's so cold and I want to get in so badly. And I wait and, you know, I wait till the conditions are perfect.
2 weeks
on one,
in August. Yes,
exactly. Well, yesterday I was out with a friend and we got so hot. We were playing tennis and she said, let's go swimming. And I said, well, I don't have a swimsuit on. And she said, that's okay. And we went to Atwater and we dove in. Later, I found out the water was 58 degrees, but it felt great. I highly recommend it.
I have to ask, how long did you stay in?
Quite a while.
Really?
I mean, at least I was in there 15 minutes and she was in there well over 20.
It's amazing. As we're having this conversation, it's July 5th. This is airing on July 6th. So that meant you were in the water on July 4th.
Yes.
And the water in Lake Michigan was 58 degrees.
I looked it up later, and that's what it seemed to be. Yes, yes. But it gets to 70 in August, so take the plunge then.
So this next section is actually a perfect carryover from the last time we spoke. And you were asking me what I was most looking forward to about summertime in Milwaukee. And I mentioned kayaking, and there are lots of places to kayak in and around the Milwaukee area.
There certainly are. And so page 42 of the July issue is dedicated to you, Mitch. we list a few different routes that are easy to get to from downtown and can really lead you into some, you know, semi-wilderness-looking places. So I don't know. I like to kayak a couple times during the summer, and I really feel that it's so magical to kayak through downtown and then to get to a place that's very close where you feel like I could be anywhere.
Right. You go north out of downtown, and it is really not too long before things start looking a lot more pastoral.
Yes, exactly. And what I like about kayaking is you could do just fine without really knowing what the heck you're doing.
There's much more on that. There's much more in the article. We should mention briefly the idea of surfing. This is not really surf season on Lake Michigan.
No, surf season on Lake Michigan is February. But they are having a big surf festival. I guess they do this every year. It's at Atwater Beach on August 4th. And I'm certainly going to go. I know how to surf.
Do you really?
I do. I have not surfed Lake Michigan.
I'm told that Lake Michigan is really, even when the surf is up, it is much more challenging than going surfing in the Pacific, because the waves come fast and furious on the lake. They're all, the waves are all wind blown, and you can get wave after wave after wave after wave. And there are some experienced surfers that talk about it being really challenging.
That, and also it's not salt water, and the buoyancy of the ocean because of the salt, it makes surfing much easier. I don't think I will be trying to surf in Lake Michigan or maybe anywhere ever again, but I did enjoy it while I did it.
And surf festivals are fun, if nothing
yes,
else.
Yes.
Carol, thank you so much.
Great to be here.
Carol Nixon is editor-in-chief and publisher of Milwaukee Magazine. The magazine feature on water recreation is the cover story of the July issue.
Speaking of water, with the iconic Milwaukee watering hole at random for sale, we revisit a classic episode of Bubbler Talk when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWN.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge. I'm WUWM's Mayan Silver with a question from Alina Katz of Glendale.
I've heard about ice cream cocktails in Milwaukee and wondering if there's something uniquely Milwaukee about them.
Did you decide yet, honey, what you like?
I think we'll do a pink squirrel.
And?
We're going to share.
Okay, you can share now, but we're not going to have sharing in the future.
Okay.
That's Shirley Zeller, taking an order from Milwaukee food writer Lori Frederick and her husband Paul. Zeller is co-owner and a waitress at the Bayview bar called At Random. It's a place that feels a little like walking into a time warp. A dimly lit interior, twinkling lights, lounge music, naugahyde booths, and a curmudgeon-y style. And yes, blended in ice cream drinks that, as Lori Frederick says, became popular post-World War II.
The ice cream drinks, a lot of them have been around in Wisconsin for a very long time. I mean, they became popularized, I think, by the Supper Club, where the idea was you came, you sat at the bar, you grabbed your brandy old-fashioned. In the meantime, you know, you order your food, you go to your table, you eat your steak and your potatoes, and then you come back to the bar at the end and have some sort of dessert, and usually that dessert is an ice cream drink. So there's this sort of full circle that it begins and it ends with the bar.
Behind At Random's bar, Shirley's son Randy says that customers who order ice cream drinks there have the same idea as those in a supper club.
Usually a good after-dinner drink. You get a lot of after-dinner people coming for ice cream.
As he scrapes a drink out of the blender and puts whipped cream on it, he talks about the signature butter cookie on the straw. How many cookies do you think you've put on drinks over your lifetime?
Probably 1,000 or more at least. Huh?
That's probably underselling it.
You're probably right.
Randy's father, Ron Zeller, opened At Random after working at another classic Milwaukee cocktail bar, Bryant's. They don't put cookies on the ice cream drinks there, but Bryant's current owner, John Dye, explains what's uniquely Milwaukee about the almond-flavored, rose-colored pink squirrel that Lori and Paul ordered.
As far as we can figure, it was invented in the late 30s or early 40s by Bryant Sharp, who started Bryant's Cocktail Lounge. It coincided with the invention of the blender, and Bryant's picked up the use of the blender right around then. We don't know if the cream came first and then they're like, let's use ice cream, or if, because this is Wisconsin, they started using ice cream and then for those people outside of Wisconsin, they could just use cream.
Brian came up with a pink squirrel during a cocktail competition.
And he invented three fairly famous ice cream drinks, pink squirrel, the Banshee, which is a banana-flavored ice cream drink, and then the Blue Tail Fly, which is sort of this delicious blue ice cream drink with an orange flavor.
Back at Random, Lori says these Milwaukee traditions are here to stay.
You know, ice cream and booze, most people think that's a good idea.
And Alina Katz would agree.
I think it's a fantastic idea.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
Are you flying anywhere this summer? Does flying make you nervous? Maybe you should keep these thoughts by Lake Effect essayist Megan Schultz in mind. Or maybe you shouldn't.
Every single time. The plane dips and my stomach drops. I squeeze the armrest and hope the person next to me can't hear me gasp. If we're close to landing and the plane is tilting toward the ground, I lift my heels off the floor and angle my toes downward. Or if we're on the ascent, I flex my toes upwards with my heels firmly dug into the floor. I read in Ask the Pilot that somehow that tricks the body into maintaining a balance, though for the life of me can't remember how. And it really doesn't work. I'm still terrified. How do you stay so calm? I remember asking Melinda as she sipped her mimosa and laughed at those of us who were not rational flyers. We were somewhere over Central California on our way to Vegas for a bachelorette party, and two drinks down when the turbulence began. I only knew the bride, my childhood bestie, but her friend Melinda was a scientist with a PhD somewhere on the East Coast, so it felt like I should trust her answer. I mean, think about it, she said. It's like we're flying over a pot of boiling water. All the bumps and dips are just pockets of air. I had no idea what she was talking about. I didn't know the physics, or was it chemistry, of temperature changes or velocity or acceleration. But ever since that explanation, when turbulence hits, I imagine I'm soaring through my kitchen in a miniature airplane over a pot of steaming chicken soup. So what do those two dings really mean? You know, right after takeoff? It was obvious from the minute he walked into the restaurant that this would be a one and done. Maybe it was because he was shorter than me and not particularly handsome. It could have been that he was American, and I was still in my seriously anglophilic phase of dating. It most definitely could have been his announcement upon arrival that a friend of his had also been on a date with me through the online site where we'd swapped profiles. The site declared itself the UK's largest dating network, so I was decidedly creeped out. Whatever the reason, I knew I would never call him back. But since we'd just settled into a pub near Piccadilly Circus, with a vodka tonic for me and a whiskey and coke for him, I thought we ought to at least have a friendly chat. Lucky for me, he was a pilot.
Lake Effect essayist Megan Schultz writes and lives on Milwaukee's East Side. And Milwaukee native Steve Miller takes us out of Friday's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Audrey and I produce the show along with Bonnie North, Joy Powers, and assistant producer Maddie Andre.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz and help from interns Ben Benversi, Lauren Keane, Gabby Powell, and Robin DiGiacinto. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is the managing editor.
Before we go, just a moment to mention that WUWM is co-sponsoring, and I am co-moderating next week's broadcast debate between the Democratic candidates seeking their party's nomination for governor. We'd like you to suggest some questions to ask. To do that, just text the word debate to 414-269-6404. That's 414-269-6404, and follow the very simple prompts. And don't forget to tune in for the debate Thursday at 6 here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
And be sure to tune in tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. And keep listening, because fresh air is next. You know I might get busted.